Thanks. Todd Jackson, alcoholic. Because of the grace of God, A, and sponsorship, I've been sober since May 25th of 89, and I'm glad to be here. I do a little Chris Farley impression, but I won't do it now. Lost about 60 pounds, so I don't do it as well. But I'd like to thank the committee and whomever's responsible for having me here. It is an honor, a privilege, even when you don't feel like it, it is. That's what I've been told, and I believe that. I'm just a white trash knucklehead. You know, whenever I get called to do this, I think, you're insane. Have you lost your mind? If you had any idea the thoughts that I think on a daily basis, you'd run for cover. You wouldn't call me. You'd board up your windows, and you know. But I guess it doesn't really matter as what I'm starting to learn. And so I am glad to be here, and I'd like to thank Bill. I want to apologize to anybody who was on I-20 today. Bill's a psychopath. I actually had to go to sleep to endure his driving. So he just tailgates people until they want to kill him. Anyways, thanks, Bill. Appreciate that. I've looked at the lineup of speakers. You have great speakers. You're going to have such a great weekend, and it is my privilege to be here. Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, has given me a life. I'm what my first sponsor said was a never was. He said, "You're not a has been. You was a never was." And I was a never was. And so, you know, for me to, I was a friend of mine and a coworker. We listened to a little tape this week. In my business, you try to be motivated in things. And one of the things that caught my ear was gratitude creates peace. And I never understood why my sponsor would have me make a gratitude list or anything. Because I get the wheels turning, and I spend a lot of time up in my head, and I get the wheels turning, I get crazy, and I have no peace whatsoever, and just crazy as I can be. Especially sometimes when you have a lot of things going on in your life that are out of your control or things that you don't like necessarily, it's very hard to just be okay, you know, where you're at. And so I had an opportunity yesterday as a result to listen to that, to try to make a little bit of a gratitude list. And you know, whenever you're not feeling very well, the list is about this long. You know, I'm breathing, you know, and I'm not even happy about that. You know? But, you know, it's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that gratitude's an action, you know, and you just show up and you do what you're supposed to do and you answer the phone and you go where you're supposed to go and you try to help people. And I only know that because people did that for me. That's been my experience because people did that for me. And so I really don't know that I could do any less. I don't know that there would be any way for me to be able to lay my head down at night if I didn't do the things that were done for me. So I am just truly grateful to be here, and I know you're going to have a great weekend. And so, you know, I first of all just have to apologize because, like I said, I'm just a white trash knucklehead, and I'm a goof. Your Friday night speaker's a goofball. That's the bottom line. So, you know, good luck. I hope it works for you. I was born in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Exactly. That's how I felt about it. Right on. There's some guy named Don back there who loves Shawnee. He says, "Do you know my uncle? Where is he at? Don, is it Don? Raise your hand. He's here somewhere. He's got an uncle and a..." Go ahead. You're not Don. Don't do that. And D-A-W-N. No. So anyway, he knows where Oklahoma, Shawnee's at. But, you know, I've always had this idea that wherever I'm at and whoever I'm with and the things that I'm doing just aren't right. You know, I've always had an overwhelming sense of not being okay. And I can remember that from the day that I have consciousness of just feeling not all right. And not really being able to put a finger on what's not right, but just knowing inside of me, sort of intuitively, that something was wrong. And knowing that it's like the weight of the world on me. Just always felt heavy and always felt like I didn't know. I didn't understand stuff. I can remember looking at things and seeing them, and it looked like the way that other people were responding to the things that were going on was okay, but the way that I was seeing it was not okay. I don't even know if I'm making sense, but it just always seemed awkward for me. Always has. Always has. And I've always, I used to think I was a deep thinker. Really, I just think a lot. You know, doesn't mean I'm a deep thinker. I just spend a lot of time thinking. Makes me very lazy. Let me, you know, take the trash out. Let me think about that a minute. You know, no, not very good in a relationship. I've also confused being quick-witted with really I'm a smart aleck, as it turns out. So, you know, I just very, very cynical, very sarcastic. I like to have fun at the expense of others. I've always been that way. I walk into a room like this and I know that you all have an opinion about me. It's probably not good. You know, just an overwhelming sense of self. I've always had that. It's not that I have a real high opinion of myself. It's just that I think of myself a lot, you know, and just crazy. And I've always been that way. And my grandparents, Bud and Sundine Fisher, they were just a real stabilizing force in my life, and they've both passed away now. And my grandpa, Bud Fisher, Garner Barry Fisher, was a postman. And over my bed, in my bedroom, there was a picture of him in his little postman outfit. And I thought, man, I'm going to be a postman. He's a cool guy. And I never saw him drink, never saw him drunk, never really remember him swearing until he got Alzheimer's. He was just a good guy, solid guy. My grandma, Sundine, she's about as big as this podium, you know, about that tall, about that big. And she just one of them gals that you'd climb up her lap and just go straight to sleep. You know, she just loved, I mean, be overwhelmed with love, you know. And they just loved me and gave me everything that I needed. They gave me patience and love and kindness and consideration and all of the things that you need, all the values and morals. And my mother is a great, great woman. My father and her got together whenever they were young. She was 15 or so and had me when she was 16, and he was 17 or something like that. They split up about 6 months later, and so, you know, there was always that I try to hang my whatever I had on. You know, my parents got divorced when I was a little kid, and that's the reason I'm a knucklehead or whatever. There were things, though, that were okay, you know, like my grandparents and my mom. She loved me so much. It's amazing how much she loved me. And, you know, we had some land. I grew up in the country, and, you know, I had a BB gun, a dog named Pepper, and, you know, I'd go out there in the field. And I remember I would look up into the sky, and I would, you know, it's like cloud busting where you're laying there and you're looking at the clouds, and, well, there's Snoopy, and there's, you know, just sort of daydreaming, I would just begin to think about being somebody else. I began to have this fantasy world about being somebody else, somewhere else, with other people. You know, maybe I'm a guy named Johnny, you know, and I rob banks, you know, and all this. You know, I mean, just really outside of me. And I don't know why. I guess a lot of people do that. But for whatever reason, I just tended to spend a lot of time thinking. A lot of time thinking always very aware of myself. No one has ever had to put me in touch with my feelings. I'm right there with them all the time. I get it. I know exactly how I feel all the time. I don't like people, really. I don't really like people. I like you if you give me stuff, you know, if you're nice to me, I'm cool with that. But other than that, I really don't like people. I hate with a broad stroke, you know, I hate whole countries, you know, I mean, I just am that person, that's how I am, and I needed a drink, is what I'm bad, she ended up getting divorced from my dad, and of course, he was the coolest guy in the whole world. He, you know, he drove a car like Starsky and Hutch, and he'd come and get me about every third Saturday, and, you know, some tragic after-school special where I'm waiting in the window for my dad, you know. This is how my mind sees it, you know. I'm crying and stuff, and, you know, just, it was really, I don't know that it was that way, but it seemed like it. And he always had a new girlfriend, which I love that about him. And so it was just, you know, just the way it was. And my mom met another guy, and this guy was a big guy, huge, incredibly big. And I don't like the big people. I'm just going to tell you, if you're good looking, you've got money, you're big, you can speak well, you've got nice hair, teeth, I don't like you. I hate you. In fact, I'll fight or run, you know, whatever it takes. And I just hated this guy, and he brought a bunch of kids with him, and they were Indian kids, and they all had brown hair, black hair and brown skin and brown eyes, and I got red hair and big ears, and I was born like 3 foot tall, 90 pounds. I came today and weighed 250 pounds, you know, got fat. So it's just very low self-image. Anyhow, they brought these kids, and they're all pretty. They just seem to be pretty. I got freckles the size of quarters. You know, I go outside, they turn green and grow together. It's just horrible. And they want to live in my area. They want to touch all my stuff, and it makes me not be able to breathe. It really does. I don't know. I mean, I get stuck not being able to breathe because they're just messing with everything, and I have things. You know, put that down on one. You know, I have things the way that I want them. Don't jack with my stuff, man. I get frustrated easily. And so finally she divorced this guy, which I thought, great. I hated that guy. You know, I have no reference point for it. It's all about me. I grew up and I know how terribly painful divorce is and how horrible it is. And all I can think is, great. I hated that jerk. You know, he was just... He loved to whip. He'd drink stag beer. Anybody drink stag beer here? Not very. It killed most people that drank it. Don, that's it. One guy. You can't see, can you? You're blind. Blind rot your eyesight. All your teeth are gone. It's horrible. But he drank that stag beer, and I remember he was just kind of mean, and I remember thinking, I'm not going to act like that. I'm not going to do that. However, and I didn't think about this until long after I was sober. I remember stealing one of those stag beers, and I went down. We lived by a lake, and other thing is, I love girls. Holy crap! I mean, I'll do anything. I'd jump headfirst off of this podium if I thought I'd get some attention from a girl, man. Boy, I don't matter to me. You know, I would do that. And so I'm bad about that. And I steal this little beer, and I go down there. I've got my bicycle, and there's these girls there, and so I'm Evel Knievel. You know, so I drive my bike. I'm going to jump a picnic table or something, and I don't know how to do that, it turns out. So I take a header off the picnic tables and bust my nose, and it's like my first alcohol-related accident, I guess. Anyhow, I mean, it served its purpose. So she got a divorce from that knucklehead, and she met another guy, and we moved to California. Which is a great deal. I thought California, great. Sun, beaches, Disneyland, all that sort of stuff. We moved to California. And I tell you, it was amazing. This guy came into my life, and he did for me what alcohol would do for me later. He sort of sealed up the gaps. I've always felt like I didn't fit, but I was somehow completely inappropriate in whatever was going on, that my being there was inappropriate. Not that it was, but that's just how I felt. And so he gave me wholeness. And I don't think there's any secret or any real, for me, any mystery in the fact that unity's in our first tradition. Because I have looked for something to plug into, something to be a part of, some way to feel connected to something my entire life. Since I have conscious awareness of my existence, I remember trying to be a part of something, to want to be connected. And this guy gave me some unity. He filled in the gaps. And we're out there, and I took his last name, and he was my dad. And he taught me how to play football and baseball and a lot of things that I love to do today, and taught me how to fish and all these things. And we were out in California, and that is where I had my first experience with alcohol that really produced the effect that was so magical, that really changed my life. And I don't know why you would think that necessarily wouldn't happen, but the unfortunate part about being a part of my life is that you don't have the power to make me feel good very long. I steal all the sweetness out of that. I mean, I drain that deal quick. I take all of the fun and all the excitement and all of the joy out of loving me. I take that away very quickly because I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, and I just drain the situation. You know, at some point, you have to be guarded whenever you're around me. And not that I'm some outlaw and I'm going to beat you up and steal your wallet. I'm more of an emotional thief. You know, I just steal your peace. I steal your love and your well-being. And so people begin to be guarded around me. And that happened out there. And I had my first real experience with alcohol out there. It was a place called Arnes Lake. And we were at a little party. and there were people there that were friends of the family, and we started drinking some beer, and it wasn't a big deal. You know, I didn't have any ominous warnings. There was no one saying, don't drink beer tonight or anything like that. I just started drinking some beer. And the most amazing thing that happened, that's ever really happened, maybe until a little bit later, happened to me that night. I just felt better. You know, it always seemed that I couldn't get a deep breath above about right here. Just sort of always labored in my breathing. I don't know that was real, but that was the sense I had. In my mind's eye, when I thought of myself in my mind's eye, I was a guy who couldn't hardly catch his breath. I'm a guy who's real anxious, and I'm still nervous. I still have a nervous disposition. I'm scratching and itching and rubbing and walking around freaking out. Just kind of how I'm wired, but I'm nervous. And so I started drinking this beer, and man, I felt better. I just felt better. I unfortunately drink too much, and things happen as a result of that. But there was that night, I got the effect that not everyone gets, and I didn't understand that. I thought for a long time that whenever you drink, everybody gets the same effect. It's the same thing. It turns out that my reaction to alcohol is abnormal. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, and it's just that way for me. And man, it just makes me it makes everything okay. I'm completely in unity with the entire universe. I'm at one with the universe. I'm okay. It's all right to be me. It's okay. I don't care. And, you know, I, again, love girls, and this little old gal comes riding over this mountain on a horse. I'm very dramatic. I see things in, like, TV land, you know. So she's riding over this mountain on this big white stallion, and her California blonde hair is blowing in the wind, and, you know, the sun's going down, and I'm in love with her, and hang on a second. Get a little excited. Anyhow, her name was Stephanie, and God, she was just beautiful, and she was bouncing all over the place, and which is exciting. And I don't remember exactly what happened, but I went up to her and I started throwing it on her and telling her my stuff. I don't know what it was really, but anyhow, I got her on the boat, and there was a little boat there. And I would like for you to believe, and for a long time I would tell that story in hopes that you would think it was a yacht or something. Because clearly I'm a yacht guy, and I have a yacht jacket and a hat probably. But no, it was a little boat like this, a little flat bottom boat, like a dinghy. It was a dinghy. And we get out, and so we go into this boat, and as with most situations in my life, there's always some kind of bull crap deal. There's always some kind of, oh, and this happened. And that night, there was a guy named Troy who fell in love with my new girlfriend, and so we're on the boat together, and had a little scrap there on the boat, and I took him out, I'm sure, and and then, because I had been drinking heavily, I peed in a Dorito bag, and then I threw up right there. And that was not what I meant to do. That was not part of the plan. The overview when I was getting ready for the night didn't include that. And that's not a big deal unless you didn't want it to happen. You know, unless you're really embarrassed. You know, unless everybody's laughing, and then it's demoralizing. I didn't mean to, you know, but there was a place that happened that night that I got to that was the most amazing place I'd ever been. It was a place where I could breathe deeply, where I didn't care. I know I've talked to literally hundreds of men, and I don't know how it is for women, but I know how it is for guys, and especially this guy. That I start drinking, and man, it's almost like lightning bolts, man. I just start feeling good. I'm, you know, let's go, man. What's up? It's like, oh, I'm just get this party going right on, man. I'm taking my jacket off. Let's do it. We going to Vegas? No, we're going to Hanging Tree. You know, we had these sophisticated places to drink where I'm from, Hanging Tree and Ghost Bridge, and they all involved the dirt road. That was the level of sophistication, and generally it involved me wearing a wife beater T-shirt, you know, and playing Lynyrd Skynyrd on my tape deck. That was the big deal. You know, that was how I was. But man, I tell you, there was just a place when I'd look in the mirror. And man, you just know it's on tonight, you know. yeah, this is good, you know. And that feeling is so amazing that I'll give up everything for that. And I don't know that. I mean, I can't articulate that at the time. I'm not, if you ask me why I do those things, I don't go into that. You know, I don't have that memorized and start talking about it. But that's it, man. It feels so good to me to be released from care and boredom and worry. It's amazing stuff. And if that does that for you, if you have that kind of reaction to alcohol, I'm going to save you a ton of money. You're going to drink. That's just that's how you don't have to go to therapy anymore. You know, throw all the books away, drop the pills, man. You're going to drink, and that's just what my experience was, and I did that. And we moved back to Oklahoma from California, and I started hanging out with the folks that my parents said were the wrong crowd. And within a few weeks, I was the wrong crowd. I was the kid that you couldn't have come to your house because I'd lock myself in your bathroom and eat everything that says may cause drowsiness. That's just. I may come out, I may not. Depends on your stock. Just the way it is. I came to, not by myself, I came to with some nudging. I was on a trampoline, and my pants weren't on right. They were on down, which kind of makes you wonder. But the Reverend Archer was waking me up, and he said, "What? You got to get off this trampoline." I was dating his daughter, and I guess I'd passed out there on the trampoline. And thank God he was a man of God, because you know, I'm sure he knew what I'd been trying to get accomplished. But I'm not sure that I'd got anything accomplished. But I know I was trying, because I always try. And so, anyhow, just crazy little things. And I'm bad to want to commit suicide. You know, heck, if I stay here long enough, you'll have to call suicide hotline probably. I just want to draw a crowd and get some sympathy if I can, you know. And I call everybody I know and tell them I'm killing myself. I've got some scissors right here and I'm going to cut my wrist with them, you know. And I call it. Of course, if you do that, they're going to send you somewhere. You get to go. You get to go somewhere. And which is not a bad deal for me. Every time I go to treatment, I get a new pair of shoes and like a girlfriend, you know. I got a wife out of one of them. Which, not always a good deal, really. If you meet someone, and I just want to share this with you. If you, you know, I know you're very emotional, especially if you're new in AA, and you meet, your eyes meet across the AA parking lot or whatever. Bro, run. Man, you need to, if you're dating someone and they got a file, it's a bad deal. I'm going to tell you, train wreck. The light at the end of the tunnel is a train. Okay, so, man, and I know there's going to be an exception to every rule, blah, blah, blah. I don't want to hear about it after the meeting, but I'm just going to tell you, be careful. I got end up going to Kansas, to St. John's or something like that up there in Kansas, and they bringing these people in shackles and chains and doggone devil worshiper out there and everything, and man, I'm from Oklahoma. We don't do that. You know what I mean? I'm not sure what we do, but we ain't that. And so, you know, like Bible Belt and then Oklahoma Buckle. Belt Buckle, man. We're like, we got OBU. In this town that I live in, we have OBU, Oklahoma Baptist University, for all the good people. And then we got St. Gregory's for the rest of the folks. No, just kidding. We've got St. Gray's, the Catholic university there, and which I did a lot of drinking at, and I didn't attend, of course, but you know, I get there, and they're bringing these people in, and this guy's out there praying. He's out there, he's drawing a pentagram with something. I don't know what he's drawing it with, a piece of chalk or something. He's standing in the middle of it. It's worshiping the devil, I guess. And I don't have anything against that. If that's your deal, I'm out there. And I don't want there bringing these people in, and this guy's out there praying. He's out there. He's drawing a pentagram with something. I don't know what he's drawing it with, a piece of chalk or something. He's standing in the middle of it. It's worship the devil, I guess. And I don't have anything against that. If that's your, just kidding. We've got St. Gray's. There's the Catholic university there, and which I did a lot of drinking at, and I didn't attend, of course, but I get there, and they're bringing these people in, and this guy's out there praying. He's out there, he's drawing a pentagram with something. I don't know what he's drawing it with, a piece of chalk or something. He's standing in the middle of it. worshiping dope, whiskey, beer, you know, have it all, take it all. You know, 2 hours later, I want, hey, you know, what'd y'all do with that? You know, I want to get that back. I've reconsidered. I'm a good starter, and just like most of us, I start well. I read every chapter in the book in the Bible in 2 days. And then I'm drunk. On the third day, I'm drunk. And on the third day, he was drunk. That's how it goes for me. That's how it is. I don't follow up well. I don't follow instructions very well. I'm smarter than most everybody that you know, probably yourselves included. I don't want to be critical of you, but I just think deeply. You guys wouldn't understand if I tried to explain. And that's how I think, you know, and so there's no helping me. You can't help me. There's no way. In fact, it begins to aggravate people, you know, them trying to help me. And it aggravates me. It says in our book, it says at first, if you start to talk to us about our drinking, that we will laugh it off. You know, yeah, I peed in a Dorito bow. I puked in a flower bed. Yeah, I woke up on a trampoline. Yeah, I wrecked a car. But then if you continue to talk to me about my drinking, I'll become irritated and I refuse to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I just start shutting people down. We're done with that, right? I punish you by not coming around, or I'll stay there, but I won't speak to you, or, you know, I'll fight, or I'll make an argument up so that we're not going to talk about that. And that's what began to happen. I started to encounter people that care, I'm sure, that I've been to psychiatrists, psychologists, preachers. Man, we used to have in Shawnee, and it still happens, but not as frequently, but they have a faith healer. And it was Friday night, man, on Friday night on Harrison Street in Shawnee. Big tent. It's right there by the salvage yard. And I've whipped in. I'm going to tell you right now, I have whipped in. I've pulled in. And if you've ever been to one of them kind of meetings, man, it's on. They are praying and praising. And you get caught up in it. You'll have them laying hands on you. I did. And I'm giving it all up, man. I'm going to travel with them, you know, because I can't just get saved. I got to preach, you know, if I'm going to do this deal. You know what I mean? If I'm going to get cleaned up, I'm going to have to be helping some folks. You know, so I start making plans to go on the road with them. And I'm drunk. I just don't make it. I don't know. I just can't pull it together. And I don't have very many friends because I'm just a thief. I just steal. You know, I'll steal $5. And if you say you saw me, I'll tell you didn't. I mean, I have that. It was one of the most terrible little compromises in integrity and character that I had. And it doesn't sound like much, but I stole $5 at a party one night, and I was drunk, and I stole it, and everybody knew I stole it. And I flat said I didn't steal it. I made a huge deal out of it. A huge deal. Fighting deal. I had to fight over it. $5. And everybody knew. And finally, everybody else just said, we don't even care. We don't even care. But I knew that I'd stolen that $5. But for years, even in sobriety, I'd tell you, if you came up to me and you said, man, you stole that $5. No, I didn't. You could have seen me do it. I'm just such a liar and so deceitful and so, I want to look good at all costs. I want to look good at all costs. And let me tell you, that can get very, very expensive, even in sobriety. And that's been a part of my life. So, you know, I don't have any solution. I'm too smart for any that there may be. I had a real bad summer with Little Kings and I had more of a summer, actually, a little love affair there for a while, and with Little Kings and Valium. It's a terrible combination for me. And I wrecked every car in every direction in my family. There was no car unscathed, you know. And you become very guarded about your keys when I'm around because I will drive your car and wreck it. And so I had gotten a car and I had been drinking for about 3 days. I was out on a little run and I had been taking some pills, which is part of my deal. And I just was in bad shape. And I spent about a week in a blackout. And I'm not exaggerating. It was really, a lot of people know about that. I mean, I had a week and I kind of came to and I was in a hospital type situation. I had some problems, and so I decided that I would remedy that with drinking. And so I went on a little run, and I got some guy said, "Here, take some of these." And of course, I don't ask any questions, and I did. And I was going to go do some work, which is not customary for me. I don't generally work. I don't really like it. But anyways, I was going to mow a lawn. And in Oklahoma, much like I'm sure Texas, it's like 175 million degrees in the summer, at least. And when you're drunk, it's hotter. It's, for some reason, when I'm drunk, it's super hot, you know. And I'm back in this tractor deal, a lawnmower, out of a truck. And I got my friend Ronnie. Ronnie's about this big, about as wide as this podium, Indian guy, big guy. Ronnie forgot to put the doggone deals up there, you know, the things you back it down on, you know. And I'm just coming off, you know. I'm coming out of the back of the truck. I didn't look, and so it turns out I rolled it on top of me. And something that I'd taken began to not agree with me. It had something to do with the heat and the tractor, I'm sure, and the intensity of the situation. And I just started getting real tight and very tingly. And I started going into a seizure. And my friend Ronnie took me in the house where his brother Junior was. And by that time, I was really drawn up, you know. Hands was like this, and my head was back. And they got me in there, and Ronnie got on my chest, and Junior got on the back of my head, and they were wrenching and raking on me. And, I mean, they had my hand, you know. And I'm trying to tell them to quit. I can't talk. And I hung back, you know, trying to cuss them out. And I finally just had to get out of there. They were killing me. And I crawled out to the car, kind of crabbed out there, you know, and got out to the car because clearly I should be driving, you know. And so my only hope seemed to be the Buick. And so I got to the Buick, and I got in there and started driving along there, and just full out went out, just, you know, chewing and flopping. And I was driving with my knee, you know. And so I ended up in some old man's yard. And, you know, he was on the front porch. He wasn't coming down to have a look because I was in my wife beater and I had hair down to my yahoo. And, my, you know, I just got an earring hanging out of every hole. And I'm as cool as the other side of the pillow, man, you know. And I was laying there and I was all like that. And I could see out of the corner of my eye this old man. And I'm thinking, you know, why won't he help me? You know, Jesus, I'm dying. Crotchety old, you know. And finally, maybe he called it. And finally, the ambulance, I heard the boo, you know, the ambulance started coming. I thought, God, thank God, you know. And my buddy Johnny, who had pulled up at the time, and he says, oh, man, you wrecked your car, you know. And he heard the boo, and he's out. I got to go, man, you know. Johnny's got warrants. He can't be hanging around to help a buddy, you know. And so Johnny left, and they got me on in the deal there, and they got me in the ambulance, and I'm opposed to restraints of any kind, 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, who do we, I don't appreciate them at all. I don't like them a bit. They had me all trapped down, and I'm fighting and hollering. And what I have learned, and this is valuable, some of you are going to go back out and drink. I know that. So if you do, and you go into convulsions, and you have to be restrained, do not cuss out the people that are trying to help you. Because, man, if you're not in a life-threatening situation, they just let you sit out there in the heat till you calm down a little bit. And I got to sit out there in the old ambulance just baking like a dang tomato. It seemed like 3 days, but they finally got me in there, and it's, you know, that they say, if you drink or do any more drugs today, you're going to die. Oh, for the love of God. How many times? Okay, right. You have no idea what I can endure. Leave me alone. I just want to go home, Jack. You know, and so the next day they let me go home. And my parents, if you can imagine this, had me living outside. I was staying in a little travel trailer. I'd like to make it sound nice, but there's no way to do that. It was not a nice. It was just a little travel trailer. And I had, I needed a shower. I had somewhere along the way had vomited, and I had had vomit in my hair, and I had grass on my, you know, if you vomit outside, you're going to get a little grass on you, aren't you? That's just the way it is. And so I had grass on me, and I smelled bad. I just want a shower because I'm trying to get this girl, Barbie, to hook up with me, and you know, I need a shower. And so I'm trying to get in the house. And whenever you're real drunk, it looks like the house is like 870 miles away. You know, you got that crazy vision going on. And I saw the light of the house, and so I took off. And you know, when you're drunk, you walk head heavy. You know, you're walking along like that, leaning this way. And I was leaning real far forward, and I hit the door before I opened it. And I just, wham, slammed, and my parents and my grandparents and everybody was in there playing dominoes and just relaxing, being normal. And here comes Knucklehead. Did I screw the tape up or something? David, you give me? Hello. Hello. Woke him up for sure. We're cutting this out. Anyhow, I really domestic situation. I'm, of course, my stepdad's a big sweetheart of a guy. He's 6'3" or 6'4". He weighed about 250. And, you know, I'm want to fight now, you know. And so I said, if you feel froggy, jump. I'm retarded. I'm going to tell you. He beat me. Good God. I mean, I've never been beat like that, and he loved me. my sweet mama, you know, she loved me so much. She hates me because I'm just a horrible human being. I steal and gross little secret stuff she has to know about me, you know, that just weird that she shouldn't know, and all the crap that I bring to the party, you know. And she doesn't like me, but she loves me, you know, more than anything. And she's out there screaming at her husband to get off of me, and I'm bleeding, and I got rocks buried in my forehead, you know. And the good news is I got a shower. So I did get in to get a shower, which was what I was trying to get done. And but while I was back there, I went into convulsions again, and I started to vomit. And so my little sister came to the door, and because I was making some noise, and somehow she got in, and she opened the door, and I remember looking up, seeing her, and it was just a horrible sight, I'm sure. And she was just pasty. The color was out of her, and she was looking at her brother, and just, and she was screaming and went and got everybody, of course. And I ended up having to go to the hospital again, and they put me in there, and I ended up going to a rehab center, and which is where I met my wife. And so I got in there, and I'm a good starter. I'm the guy that in treatment, about 20 days in, I'm sort of in charge of everything. You know, I'm walking around with a notebook, giving out chores and stuff. You look like a garbage man to me. And we're going to put you in charge of garbage. Oh, jeez. But I always get in trouble. I always get busted for making out or something weird, you know, and I always get broken down to private or whatever it is. And so I remember being there, and my little lovely bride-to-be, I didn't get to meet her right away because she was in solitaire. She had broken out a window with a doggone chair, which is quite a turn on to me, as it turns out. I didn't know that. I was pretty excited when I found that out. I start, you know, slicking my hair down, you know, when is she coming out, you know? And she seduced me in the center. It's not that funny. That could happen. She did. And, we got out of there, and I sponsored her for a little while, and we got pregnant. It happens when I sponsor someone, I guess, a woman. Sorry, Bill. I sponsor Bill. Bill's not pregnant at all. But it was really weird, and we were talking, you know, I'm a great starter. I say everything they want to hear, and then I get out. And I go to meetings drunk. Or high or something. I go in and I get a cup like this, and I fill it like this full of sugar and top it off with a little coffee. And I get up 8, 10, 12 times during the meeting, just so you know I'm there. You know, make a lot of noise, talk to my neighbor, you know, make sure everybody knows I'm there. Not listening, don't have any regard for you. I don't care whether you hear anything or not. And that's how I go to meetings. I don't get a lot of recovery out of meetings. And I really hate most of the people that are there because they're old. And they look at me mean. They cut me off of coffee. You can't have any more coffee, boy. Sit down. And by this time, I've been to AA, Jack. You can't tell me what to do in AA. You know, I know that. Well, turns out they can. around our group, then, you know, they'll tell you, they'll put you to the door, man. And so I had to behave myself. But I hate going to AA and be drunk and hate it. We ended up getting married. The baby died. She had to have a little operation. And here's my thing. I'm so self-centered that I think God kills babies because I'm a pervert. That's what I think. Wow, that's heavy duty. I mean, I am so self-aware and so self-centered and just so consumed with myself that I think because of the little nickel and dime compromises that I've made and the little perverted actions that I've taken and the pain that I've caused people, that God killed this baby. That's what I thought. Now, I don't want to rehash that with anybody after the meeting. I understand what the reality of that is, but that's the level of my selfishness was there. Boy, I could not get that out of my head. It just kept going on and on and all over me. And, you know, I can't get that out of my brain. I can't stop that, you know. And we got married anyhow, and because that's what I thought you were supposed to do. And we did that, and it was just insane. It was sick. And she had been to the nut house a couple times and been to treatment centers. And we were perfect for each other, really. You know, I mean, it's perfect. We both loved me, hated her. You know, it was great. It was really, really sick, crazy. She decided one time she was going to get sober, and she was always making threatening remarks like that at me, and which I take that as a threat. I don't like being sober. I've been sober. I have had to be sober a little while, and I don't like it at all. I get so sober, I choke her. We had been snowed in Edmond one time at her mother's house for about 3 days, and I didn't have nothing to drink, no dope. It would snow up to here, nothing. And I came out of what I can only think was some sort of an emotional blackout, and I'm on top of my wife choking her. And I don't mean lovingly caressing her throat. I'm eye-popping, gagging, hitting me in the head, get off of me, scratching my neck, get off of me. That's sober. That's how I'm sober. You know, and I got these doctors saying, don't you drink now. Wow, I'm having confusion about my state of being. So I just don't know what to do. And I'm going to the doctors and all that. And so we rock along there, and she decides she's going to get sober, and she does that. She gets sober. And we had a lot of insanity in our home, as you can well imagine. She went, and she was a good example of AA. She would get up in the morning, she would go to work, she would come home, and she would clean the house, and I wasn't working, because I was not much of a worker, really. And so she would get ready for the meeting, and she'd go to the meeting, she'd come home, and she'd read her big book, and she'd go to bed. That was her day. That was how she stayed sober. And she was in fellowship with people, and I, of course, automatically knew that she had a boyfriend down at the group, you know, and so I'm stalking the group from a distance, you know, because I don't get too close, and hate everybody, and, you know, it was crazy, and I left there, and I ended up in Irving, Texas, and I spent about the last week of my drinking and just insanity before Alcoholics Anonymous in Irving, Texas, and my dad was there, and he had come back into my life, and he liked to party, and we tore it up for several years together, and he ended up there, and I ended up there with him, I didn't know what to do. I couldn't stay sober, and I couldn't stay drunk, and I couldn't be sane. It wasn't that I was some lunatic. I wasn't running around, you know, banging people over the head with pots and pans. I just couldn't keep a thought. I mean, stuff would fly out of my head and fly into my head, and all the things that had gone on in my life were rolling around, and I couldn't. The book describes, it says, it talks about we're a prey to emotions, and we're, you know, we can't hope, we can't keep a job, we can't really be of help to anyone, and all of that is talking about untreated alcoholism, and that's what I had. I just didn't know it, and it was crazy. Prey to misery and depression is what it says, and that was me. Absolute prey to, I mean, I just could not shake it. And I'd been in rehabs, and I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd been doing all kinds of stuff, and, you know, I was out of ideas. I just didn't have any more ideas. I'd had double hernia surgery, and I'd was in bad shape, and I walked all hunched over, and I weighed about 112 pounds, and I'd shaken real bad, and I had the sweats, and I'd broken out into some kind of a stupid rash. I don't even know what it was, I don't know if they have them here in East Texas or not, but they got what they call yard narcs in Oklahoma, and you don't really ever get a good look at them. because they're kind of shadowy. They live just outside of your ability to see them. If you move real quick, they're there, they'll cause you to sit by your door or your window. And, I had aluminum foil on my window with a little peek hole there, checking for yard narcs, It causes me to carry my gun, you don't get a lot of visitors. And so that was the state of my being, and I just didn't know what to do. And I went and saw a lady because I kept having run-ins with AA and with recovery and treatment centers and all that kind of stuff. And I went to see a lady who in our community was very well known for helping alcoholics. And she just passed away last week, as a matter of fact. Her name was Marge Jones, and she was a beautiful, beautiful lady. She saved my life. And I went to see her, and she said to me, "Son, you need to get help." And I was very aware of that. And she brought a big guy in, and he sat down, and he started telling me about the AA deal. And I said, "Look, listen, dude, first of all," I called him dude. "Listen, dude," he didn't like that. "First of all, don't call me dude," he said. And I started telling him all I know about it. He said, "You don't know nothing." He used a lot of language. "You don't know blankety blank blank about nothing. If you would sit down and shut up, you might," okay. Wasn't much in fighting shape. And so I just took a seat, and he kind of broke through that. And they put me in, they had a guy come and get me, and he took me to a detox center, and I spent a few days there, and I wasn't in very good shape. I wasn't in any worse shape than anyone else, really. I was just in bad shape for me, and I weighed about 112 pounds, and I was just sick, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I wanted to die. I was at a place in my life where I wanted to die terribly, horribly. I mean, every day when I woke up, I wished I hadn't. I wanted to die. But I wasn't crazy enough to just go on and do it. And I don't know that there's any worse place to exist than to be in a position where you want to die so badly, but then not be crazy enough to just go ahead and do it. And I know people who have done that. I know people who've made the supreme sacrifice. I know people personally that have taken their own life and how miserable they must have been before they did that. And I was there at that place many times. It seemed like it was just where I stayed. And I just didn't know what to do. And they wanted me to do exercises. I'm out on that. I ain't doing that. I'm just laying here. And they gave me Vistaril and Librium. They tried to get me calmed down. And I finally calmed down. And somewhere around then they stopped. I stopped taking that on the May 25th or May 24th. My sobriety date's May 25th. I went to find Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know why. Maybe it was because my wife at the time had been, at that time, had been sober. She was a good example. She was staying sober. I knew that she needed to. Maybe it was because those old guys in those meetings, I got that love meant they would tell you what to do. I think that takes a lot of love to tell someone to sit down. "You're disturbing our meeting." I think it takes a lot of love to do that. Maybe I sensed that. Did they talk about it being the language of the heart? Maybe that language of the heart communicated to me, and I knew that they loved me and I needed to go to AA. Maybe I related to the stories there. I don't know. But I went to find a guy named Steve because in one of the treatment centers I'd been to, he had been doing the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want to know why people go to treatment centers and talk to people like me who don't care and think you're stupid, it's because when a guy like me is dying and has no other options, he goes to look for you. And I went to find this guy that I made fun of when he would come out there. And you had to have a sponsor to get out of the joint that I was in, and I wrote his name down. Now, he didn't know he was my sponsor. In fact, my wife and I went to find a house to rent one time, and it was his. We pulled up there, and he came walking out, and we just scared the crap out of me. And he didn't know that. He didn't know he was my sponsor. But I went to find that guy that night. I don't know why necessarily, just because he was there, because he was doing what we're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I went and found him. And the most important thing, I talked to you earlier about drinking. That first time that I drank and had experienced the effect produced by alcohol was an important thing. It was a life-changing experience for me. The single most important thing that's ever happened to me, the most life-changing experience I've ever had, happened to me that night with that guy. And it wasn't because his name was Steve or he was some great and wonderful person any more than I am or you are. It was the fact that I went and I talked to him and we related. I identified with him. The book Alcoholics Anonymous has a chapter called Working with Others. And it outlines exactly what to do with a guy like me. He told me his story. He told me when I started getting serious, he told me stories that were serious. He bore down on the malady. He talked about the fact that, yeah, you're right, you're not getting better, you're getting worse. you are getting worse, aren't you? Yeah, man, I'm getting worse. I can't sleep. I don't eat. Man, I'm just going crazy. And then I would start telling him funny stories or maybe crack a smile. He'd tell me funny stories about his drinking. We matched our mental inconsistencies. He did that with me. He allowed me to know that I was not some creature that there was no hope for. He brought me into the realm of reality and said, it's okay, I know what you have. And he shared with me his life. And he did that in a way that the desperation that I experienced, I was completely desperate. I was just overwhelmed with it. I didn't know what to do, which is the greatest place for an alcoholic, at least of my type, to be. I did not know what to do. That desperation, coupled with the identification that took place that I believe can only take place with one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic, created a willingness in me to do things that I would never do. I ain't going to meetings on Fridays. I'm not gonna. Now, I don't necessarily have anything to do on Fridays, but I ain't going on Fridays because I might have something come up. You know, and I'm not going to go to meetings early. I don't want to shake anybody's hand. I don't want to go to coffee with anybody. That's stupid. I'm not going to hold your hand during the prayer, for sure. I don't know what you're thinking about, but I ain't doing that. You know, I mean, I just got a lot of things I'm not going to do prior to that meeting with that guy. And after that meeting with that guy, I signed up. I mean, I bought what he was selling. He started telling me stuff, and I just started nodding my head. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me. And he sort of set the hook, and he said, we're going to talk about discipline, structure, and commitment. Now, all of those words are foreign to me, but I don't like the way they sound. You know? I mean, I don't necessarily know a lot. I quit school in 10th grade or 9th. I mean, I'm not a very smart person, but I know that some of those sound like there might be work involved or something, and I don't want any of that. But I was so desperate, and the identification process took place so perfectly at that time for me. That window of opportunity, that window of opportunity was there, and it happened just right, that I said, what do we got to do? And he did exactly what the book said. The book says, outline a program of action. Tell them exactly how you recovered. He didn't say, you know, this one will be good. Here's the young alcoholic and the Indian Native American. He didn't hand me a bunch of pamphlets and a big book and say, hey, man, good luck. He said, here's the meetings that I want you to go to. And here's where I'll be. This is what I expect. I mean, he gave me a program of action. He wrote it down. He said, if you can read, you don't have any excuses. Now, can you read? And I said, yes. He was serious when he asked the question. He wasn't kidding. And I said, yeah. He said, then there's no excuse. He told me, I want you to call me every morning at 7:15, not 7:14, not 7:16. I didn't have a phone, which made it almost impossible, you know. Okay, I'm not going to be able to do this because I have a phone. Well, go to your mother's house and use the phone. Oh, crap. So I'm already the biggest loser in three counties, so now I got to struggle down. My car's broke down, so I have to walk. And it wasn't really my car. My grandpa had co-signed. I owed about 6 payments to Chrysler. You know, if they could have found it, it was hidden back behind the shed, and I wouldn't have had it. But, you know, it was broken down. And so, why pay? I'm not paying for it if it doesn't run. You know what I mean? And so, I walked down there, and I would call him every day, and he would say, this is what I want you to do every day. He would tell me what to do, and I would do those things every day, and I would get to the meeting early, and I would shake hands, and we went on road trips, and he taught me how to be where I was supposed to be and do the things that I needed to do for recovery. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know that's what he was training me to do. I didn't know that he was giving me a program of action. I didn't know that he was creating a way of life for me that worked whenever things got tough. I didn't know that. But that's what was happening for me. He was giving me a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous that couldn't easily be shaken. That couldn't easily be shaken. And he did that for me, and I'm grateful. He saved my life. And it wasn't that it was him as much as it was the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and the experience that he'd had with it, that he was passing that along, doing what we're supposed to do here. And so, you know, my wife and I, we got back together, and we'd been split up as a result of the way we were living, and we got back together, and we soon had a child, and my first child was born, and it was an amazing deal. We were sober, and any time I do something, I'm the golden boy, you know, I love chip night, you know, my group, but if I'm getting a chip, man, I'm going to give like about an 85-minute talk about 30 days of sobriety, you know, what that means, you know, and so, but it was amazing. We had this baby, and my mom happened to be the head of OB at this little small-town hospital. It was almost like they ran everybody else out and let us have a baby that night, and the crowd, there was a crowd of people there from AA and from Al-Anon. The first person I saw when the baby was born, I came out, was my sponsor, and he kissed me on the cheek, and he's plugging cigars in everybody's mouth, you know, and and he said, can you believe this? And I was bawling. I said, no, I can't believe this. You know, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm white trash. I don't make it. I don't get here. I don't make it, you know. And I was there, and everyone was there, and they took care of us. And, you know, my wife and I separated, and because of some challenges that we had. I just make decisions based on stuff that put me in a position to be hurt. That's just the way I am. I'm a selfish and self-centered human being, and I do that. Self manifested in various ways sum me up. And that happened. We've separated, and it was crazy. And we got back together, and we just started doing AA. And I surrendered at another level about that AA was going to be a way of life for me. That that's what I was going to do, that it wasn't a place that I was passing through, that I was just doing AA until something better came along. And that was a big deal for me at the time, because I'm a kind of guy that I want to keep a foot in the back door. You know, I want to keep all my options open. And it was explained to me that I needed to put my bags down and just be here. And I did that. And I've been here ever since. I haven't found it necessary to leave. And, my experience has been that life happens. If you breathe in and out every day, life happens. It just is the way it is. Good things happen. I got an incredible job, which was an incredible thing. You know, when I got sober, my wife had a job. My thing was, look, we're not a two-income family. I don't really need a job. You know, I'm trying to focus on my recovery, you know, which not a lot of people buy that in my home group. You know, they're on you about getting a job. And so anyway, I had to get a job. But, you know, I ended up getting this job at a bank, and they trained me and sent me to some classes and stuff. And I'm making loans, and I've got this office, and it's an amazing thing. You know, some amazing things started to happen in my life. And I started to sponsor guys. You know, my sponsor took me out on 12-step calls when I was brand new and initiated me into the real work of Alcoholics Anonymous, at least in my experience, early on. They taught me how to work with the newcomers, showed me what to do, take me out. You know, I was the youngest person in our home group, and so I kind of was the mascot. You know, they would take me out to pick up some guy who was about 900 years old, and his liver was as big as this podium, you know, and they'd make me sit in the back with him. You know, he was like, I'm glad you got sobered up when you did, boy. You know, I hope you die right here in the car. You know, I hope your liver explodes now. And I just hated them. And I would look in the mirror, and Steve and Rodney, usually was Rodney, be laughing. Oh, they thought it was funny. Touch my liver, boy. Feel this, you know. And I'd get out of the car, and I'd slam the door as hard as I could slam it. You know, and I would just float into the house and lay down and go right to sleep. And see, for a guy like me, I don't go right to sleep. I got a lot of thinking to catch up on when I lay down. You know, I got some things I got to square up from the day or the years before when I'm trying to sleep. And I just lay down and just go straight to sleep. And it was amazing. And I really am a believer that when all else fails, work with another alcoholic saves the day. It's been my experience recently that works when everything else fails. And, you know, I've just trained and brought up in Alcoholics Anonymous in a very action-oriented way, that we do things here, that action, that it's not into thinking, it's into action. That's what that chapter is in our book, and that's what we do. And we take the steps, and we practice the traditions in our home group, and that we stand for something, not against something, but we stand for the principles in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that we just do what we're supposed to do. You know, we're there with our hand out, and those things have served me well, and I didn't know how valuable those types of lessons would be to me, you know, and I was caught in a situation where I was at a country club, which I hate country clubs, because I, of course, am not a member of any, so I hate them naturally. And I hate people who go to them because I don't go. And I was there with a job that I had, and I just feel so out of place. And the first thing that sort of came to me was I stuck my hand, and it happened to be the president of the bank. And I didn't know that. Hey, I'm Todd. You know, I didn't say I'm an alcoholic. Of course, it was close. You know, I am Todd. Nice to meet you. And just, you know, I mean, those sort of real simple principles and actions saved my life over and over again. And I, you know, my had a lot of things happen in the last few years that I won't go over all of them, but just a lot of things have happened I'm so grateful for the foundation that I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful that the people that I came in contact with when I got here didn't say, here's a book, here's some pamphlets, good luck. Keep coming back. I'm so glad they didn't do that they took me by the hand and they walked with me. It says, walk day by day with a new man, you know, and that's what they did with me. And because I've had things going on in my life that are unacceptable to me, I've done a lot of things that are unacceptable. But what I know is that if I'll stay on the path and keep trying and go where I'm supposed to go and take the actions, that I'll be okay. You know, my grandmother died, and I didn't think I could handle that. My little old granny, she wore that taboo perfume, and man, I love that grandma of mine, you know. And in fact, last year for my birthday, a couple of guys I sponsored got me a little bottle of that. I keep it on my refrigerator, you know. It just smells good, makes me feel good. And she died. My granddad died. He had Alzheimer's, my hero. You know, he'd call 70, 80 times a day, you know, tell me about the war, you know. And I'd give anything to hear the phone ring today. You know what I mean? And whenever he died, he called me. He was dying, he called me. And I went to his home, and I tried to help him, and we prayed the Lord's Prayer with him. My wife and I prayed the Lord's Prayer, and we said, and I'm selfish in nature. I don't want him to leave because a part of me is connected to him, and he is a source of comfort and security for me. And because you guys have squeezed me out of me enough, I was able to say, Grandpa, it's okay. Go ahead. You're all done here. Go. You know, that was very difficult for me, but he was able to go. And, you know, my dad died. My stepdad died, and he had brain tumor, and he passed away. And it was tough. It was a tough time. He was in excruciating pain, and I was in the air when he passed away. I was trying to get there, you know, I was the guy that if there was a family meeting or if there was a big deal, you know, they just wouldn't tell me. If they did tell me, it meant I was going to treatment. You know what I mean? It was like that. That's how it was. You know, and I remember they were gathered around his bed, and they knew I was in the air, and I was calling them every layover, and I said, here, I'm coming. And they would say, okay, now, what are we going to do? And they were including me in it. You know, I was included. I was in unity with my family. I was in unity with my family. I'd been trying so hard to be in unity with things and to be in harmony with the things around me, and there I was. I was. And you know, my youngest son was born, and he was born blue, and they said, you know, oh my God, one of those kind of deals. And I don't know a lot about praying, and I'm not a very spiritual guy, but because repetition strengthens and confirms habits, I fell on my knees and I started to pray the only prayer I really know, which is the Our Father, because we say it after every meeting, you know. And I was 8 years into the deal or so whenever he was born, and I just knew that prayer, and I started praying it, and he started crying. He ain't shut up yet, you know. He's a little knucklehead just like me. Save him a seat, and guarantee you. Anyway, but I tell you that, I didn't pray that prayer and God saved that baby. That's not what I mean to transmit to you. I don't think that happened. I don't think I got down there, said the prayer, and God put the mamma jam on it, and boom, saved that little boy. Now, he could if he wanted. He's a big boy. He can do whatever he wants. But what I really believe is that I got down on my knees and surrendered and said that prayer, and I was okay. I was okay for that brief moment. You know, there was something inside of me that was okay. And for most of my life that I'm conscious of, there's been a place inside of me that's never been okay. No matter what's going on, no matter how good it is, no matter what the girl is or what the deal is or what the money is or what the situation or the job, I'm not okay. There's a place in me that knows it. It's getting ready to change, and it's got changing for the better. It's going to get worse. It's getting bad again. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes. Here it comes. And for the most part, now I have my days, believe me, that's not true. And I would suggest to you that may be a spiritual experience. As limited as mine may be, as limited as it may be, I think that's probably it. That there's a place in me that knows that I'll be okay. I believe that. I mean, I've been struggling the last few months going through some stuff in my family life that I've been struggling. And I'm telling you, I'm just going to be honest with you. I want to check out. I don't want to go to no more meetings. You know, I don't want to answer the phone. I don't want to do all this stuff. But because there's that little place that's been changed, it's like once you're awake, you don't get to go back to sleep. I struggle to the phone, and I struggle back, and I say, I got a new sponsor, and I'm going to take the steps, and I'm going to do the things that I know to do in Alcoholics Anonymous that save people's lives, because I watch your lives be saved. I watch it happen. I see the men that I sponsor be okay. And if it can happen, our book says that if it can happen among us, it can happen with you. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. And so, you know what, I don't know a lot of things, but I know that my path has seemed to be of service. It seems to be about trying to help a newcomer. That, you know, if I could move into a treatment center and just help new guys all day long, didn't have to work, I'd be all right. It's all that working and family stuff that gets me down. But I love that working one-on-one with a new man. That's my kind of business, and I like that a lot. And I enjoy sitting down after a meeting and talking. I just love that, you know, and because of the training I've had and the lessons that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous by people who've been willing to take the time to teach me, I know that that works. I know that when it says in our literature that work and self-sacrifice for others is a deal, when it says that only by doing that I'll be able to survive the certain trials and low spots that lie ahead, I know that's true. I know that. That's my experience. My faith has been born from my experience. My experience is that's true. And so what I know is that if I'll stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous where the action is, where the things are going on, not on the edges where everybody's griping and bitching, but in the middle where people are doing something, where the live eyes are, that I can be okay, because that is where the action is. And my experience is that if it works for me, it can work for you, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.